The first people to seek oil in the area surrounding the Caspian Sea didn't have to work very hard to find it. They could simply dig in with their hands. That ended in the late 19th century with the onset of the first oil boom, and since then, oil men and government officials from all over the world have been digging in as well, especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union. That was when Steve Levine traveled to the Caucasus in Central Asia to serve 11 years as a foreign correspondent for various publications. His new book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea, is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Levine to the show. Hello.
Hi.
Could you describe the geography of the Caspian Sea? How has this region been historically important in the past?
The main role that it's played is the one you described during the late 19th century, the early 20th century.
Not caviar? Oh, so caviar was the big thing there.
Well, it was the, okay, two things. It was the oil capital of the world. It mesmerized the world at that time and produced 51% of the world's oil. But as you say, it also produced 98% of the world's caviar.
How do the oil reserves there compare to Saudi Arabia or Venezuela?
It's not of the same magnitude, not of the same volume. The importance of the volumes that it does have is in the next decade, it's going to be exporting 5 million barrels of oil a day, and that's enough to spell shortage or surplus or a price spike on the world market.
If oil was so easy to find before anyone knew what to do with it, what did the people of the area think was going on?
They used it for years, since the 12th century, since the 13th century, as a lubricant for mange on animals, and they also used it to light their lamps.
Mm. So they understood that it actually was combustible and that it had real uses. But when did the oil seekers start showing up in the region? Was that the 19th century?
It was. They understood, just to go back, because it's such an interesting thing, they understood it was combustible because it would spontaneously light. It would deliberately light, and the people actually would cook their food right there on the surface of the earth, light the ground, dig a hole, light the ground, and put their pot down there. So they understood that, and then in the 19th century, yeah, there was a huge boom that was contemporaneous with the U.S. oil boom.
So the Pennsylvania oil fields first, and then there right away, right afterward?
Well, actually, the first oil boom was in Baku. The difference was in Pennsylvania, they were using what we know as drilling equipment and pumping equipment. In Baku, as we've said, you just dig in the ground and use a bucket.
Why was it necessary and cheaper for Russia to import kerosene from Pennsylvania-based oil wells when there was all of this oil close at hand?
So John Rockefeller was able to ship in the 19th century his kerosene all the way from Pennsylvania, 8,000 miles, more cheaply than it could be brought from Baku, as you just suggest. It was the transportation system, exactly the same issue that vexes the area today.
Although we'll talk about a pipeline in just a moment.
Sure.
Is what's happening there now a contemporary version of the great game during which Britain and Russia worked to gain supremacy over this region?
It is. It is. There's an enormous rivalry for influence starting in the 90s between the U.S. and Russia, but there's also now China, Iran, Turkey, all of them vying for influence.
My guest is Steve Levine, who spent 11 years in the Caucasus and also in Central Asia reporting for a number of different publications. Now he's written a book called The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How much did you know about this region when you were sent there in 1992?
I only knew about the romance of the area, having read Peter Hopkirk and Charles Marvin, two chroniclers of the great game. And this was a region that I knew and colleagues knew as an area of romantic history and this great game battle. And that's why I wanted to go.
And this was just after the fall of the Soviet Union, wasn't it?
Yeah, 21 days after the fall of the Soviet Union, and is when I arrived in Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan. And fairly quickly, within months or a year, I understood that this new great game was underway, and the characters were in this new great game were the ones I was interviewing every day.
So the first oil boom occurred in Azerbaijan, in Baku, but now it's all around the Caspian Sea?
Well, the boom started, the 19th century boom started in Azerbaijan, but the Nobel family and the Rothschilds family, who the European families who were the biggest barons of them all, spread that boom all around the Caspian into present-day Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. And so then when the Berlin Wall came down and Gorbachev declared the Soviet Union open for business, and these oil men who had been locked out, Western oil men on the outside, all of these decades rushed in. They rushed in all around the Caspian.
So Ludwig Nobel is the man who really made this into a viable source of petroleum?
Well, he was the oil king of Baku, the brother of Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, and he himself was responsible for 9% of the total world supply of oil, and he was also a great inventor. He invented the oil tanker, for example.
So were the Nobels and Rothschilds to Baku what Rockefeller was to Standard Oil?
Very much. And incidentally, they defeated Baku. There was a great 30-year oil war between the Nobels, Rothschilds, and Rockefeller for the East Asian market. And the Nobels and Rothschilds won that battle.
Now, this is petroleum that's under the water, isn't it?
In those days, it was on land, and almost all of that has been depleted. Now they're offshore.
So they first started drilling for oil near the seashore, the Caspian Sea. It's a seashore.
It is, and it's right there. The old oil fields are right in the city of Baku.
So you still see the oil derricks?
They're all over the city. It's like a museum, but it's really a sad kind of museum, these dark, black, decrepit oil derricks surrounded by these pools of dried up crude.
There is another important figure in the story, although his name isn't so easy to pronounce, Zeynalabdin Tagiev.
Exactly. Tagiev was really the patriarch of Baku during the 19th century. He struck oil when he was already in his 70s, and then became very, very wealthy, and died at the age of 101.
At the fall of the Tsarist regime in Russia, this whole area declared itself independent. But then the Red Army marched in because it was seen as such a valuable resource.
Well, it's a traditional part of the Russian Empire. And so it was natural that when the Bolsheviks seized power in St. Petersburg, that they were going to seize the whole empire too. And it took them 3 years, but they marched into Baku on horseback, seized
Leon Trotsky.
Trotsky? Well, Stalin was there. Now Trotsky, I don't think so. Stalin, in fact, got his start in Baku. But they seized all of the barons, and some of them fled, some of them were jailed, and some of them were killed.
Did the Soviet Union take advantage of these oil fields? Did they improve ways of retrieving the oil?
Well, at first, the oil fields had been completely destroyed by the Civil War, by the Revolution. And Lenin, in order to revive the fields and really save the revolution, he invited Americans and Germans to come in. And a New York entrepreneur named Henry Mason Day was the first one to arrive, and he is primarily responsible for the revival of the Baku fields.
But the oil barons had all fled when the Soviets came in.
They had both fled, been imprisoned, and some of them went insane.
Insane because they were so upset by what had happened?
There were different cases for different barons. One, for example, you named Taguieff. His wife, from the ignominy, the obscurity after all these years of being the wife of a famous baron and aristocrat, was driven insane by having been moved into a one-room apartment, and she was found dead one morning in the doorway of a bakery.
They were confined to the small house.
Yes, yes.
So they were, in effect, under house arrest after having been the lords of the town.
Yeah, they had everything taken away from them. You can see, I mean...
Well, he had been a shoemaker, so he was going from low to high and then back to low, wasn't he?
Right. He didn't become wealthy until quite late in his years, and he himself did not suffer. He died before the worst of it. It was the family.
But the way you describe this, the Soviets were rather neglectful of this vast natural resource. They didn't... I mean, they had an incredible resource here, comparable to some of the other great oil fields of the world, and they really weren't taking advantage of it. You would have thought, with the growth of Soviet industry, that this would have been a main area of focus for them.
Well, in fact, they did take advantage of it. The Soviet Union became, along with Saudi Arabia, the largest oil producer in the world. It was producing 12 million barrels of oil per day. But what you're referring to is the neglect of modern techniques of developing the oil that allows for full production. And they really ruined a lot of their fields so much that 80-90% of the oil was left in the ground.
Although in 1947, they did create the world's first offshore oil city called Oily Rocks.
This is an amazing sight that's still there offshore of Baku. When you fly in to Baku, you can still see it. It's the first offshore oil city. Thousands of workers lived out there. And the world simply couldn't believe that could be done. It was a feat for the industry. But when the first oilmen arrived in the 90s, once the Soviet Union was breaking up, they found that it was falling into the sea again from the Soviet practice of neglect.
They flooded wells to make the oil come up to the surface.
That's flooding wells itself is not a bad practice. This is done around the world, but it's how you do it. It has to be carefully calibrated so that you know exactly how much to put in, not to ruin the oil.
My guest is Steve Levine. His book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea, is published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Steve Levine, who was a foreign correspondent for 18 years, posted in the Soviet Union, Pakistan, and the Philippines, reporting for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Financial Times, and Newsweek. And for 11 years, he was in the Caucasus and Central Asia, working for various publications. It was in a time of oil excitement and oil boom, and he has written a book called The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea, published by Random House. And I assume that you wish that somebody had written a book like this before you got there. Maybe it would have saved you some trouble.
The whole point of the book is that when I arrived, when others arrived, there simply was not a roadmap, if you will, of who these people were, who were the characters, what went on. And what I did was I took the journalism that I'd been doing all those years and returned to the local characters, the Azerbaijanis, the Russians, the Kazakhs, the Turkmen, the Americans and Europeans, and I asked them, okay, what really happened when you guys were behind closed doors? What did you guys say? What did you really do? And it's all there.
There were middlemen like the Dutchman John Deuce and the American James Giffen who came to the area.
These are, in my opinion, the most interesting of all the figures, more so than the presidents, more so than the oil men, because they got their Deuce, the Dutchman, and James Giffen, who lives right here in New York, arrived there under their own steam, connected to no country, no company, and they managed, through their own guile, to insinuate themselves in these very biggest deals and in the palaces. And I wondered, if it were me, how would I do that? What was it about a person that gave them the talent for repeatedly ending up in these very powerful roles?
And this is in the last days of the Soviet Union when Gorbachev was in power?
Deuce arrived then. Now, Giffen had been going there since the days of Brezhnev. He launched himself into the Kremlin during the days of detente and managed to hold on during the whole Soviet period. The Soviet Union broke up, launched himself into Kazakhstan, and for a time controlled the very biggest oil deals in the whole world.
Well, they were part of the formation of the American Trade Consortium, weren't they?
Giffen was.
And then Gorbachev actually was willing to open up the Caspian to him and Western development because he saw it as inefficient? Or
he was desperate.
There money to be made?
He was desperate. The Soviet Union was falling apart. Giffen promised him that through his scheme, the American Trade Consortium, he would bring a group of American blue chip companies into the Soviet Union and help revive the Soviet economy. And part of the deal was that Gorbachev had to allow the Chevron Corporation into Kazakhstan.
And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, he shifted his alliance to Nursultan Nazarbayev, the Kazakh president.
He did. Really, Chevron precipitated that. They fired him. The head of Chevron overseas, Dick Matsky, could not get along with Giffen and fired him. And Giffen simply went over to the other side and started advising the Kazakhs.
Meanwhile, all these Western petroleum companies saw the fall of the Soviet Union as a real opportunity for them. So you have Chevron, you have Pennzoil, you have British Petroleum, all seeking a piece of the pie?
It was a catfight. You know, Nubar Gulbenkian, the son of the famous Mr. 5%, Kalust Gulbenkian, said, when I watch oil men, I don't know if they're fighting or making love. And he was describing the 1920s, but it was very appropriate for what the shenanigans that the oil companies got into during the 1990s.
Must have been a very exciting time for the new leaders of these newly independent countries.
What a heady time for them. They went from being serfs, really, of the Kremlin to being in charge of their own country and part of the book and their
they had just been political hacks up until then.
Yeah, and suddenly they needed to learn how to run their own show and part of the story is their search for true national independence.
Can you describe what's been called the contract of the century that Azerbaijan President Haydar Aliyev signed with oil companies in 1994?
Yeah, just briefly, you had every major oil company you can think of was in Baku, all of them struggling for a piece of this. Russia was there trying to block a deal because it saw these fields as still part of their inheritance from the Soviet Union. Azerbaijan was trying to again to cement its national independence and saw an alliance. Really, they saw it as a treaty among nations that would cement their independence. And they finally signed this deal, and it was an amazing ceremony because it did mean, in effect, the independence of the country. But just
who did they sign it with?
With nine oil companies from all over the world. But just to put a punctuation on that, the same day it was signed, Russia issued a statement, a diplomatic statement: we do not recognize this contract, and we reserve the right to attack any installation on the Caspian Sea that we haven't approved of.
So where does that stand now? Because there was another factor here. The Clinton administration got involved in all of these negotiations.
Exactly. During the mid-1990s, specifically in 1996, the Clinton administration decided that it was going to get behind these republics. It was going to, in effect, defend them. And the way that—
Even though they were all dictatorships.
Yes, yes. The fact of their stated attempt to progress toward democracy and to sign these oil deals, the Clinton administration and on into the Bush administration saw it in U.S. interest to make them pro-Western, to cement their economic independence.
So what does that mean in terms of U.S.-Russian tensions? Since the deal seems to be going through, does that mean that this is one of the things that Putin fights with George Bush about when they meet in private?
Well, those deals are all done, and the materialization of the U.S. presence on the Caspian was the construction of an independent oil pipeline that came online last year. But the bigger question, this new great game that you asked about earlier, that is a definite part and a deep part of the friction between Bush and Putin.
And we're seeing all sorts of problems in the area. For example, right now there's a lot of unrest in Georgia. And doesn't this pipeline, the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline, go through Georgia?
Yes. It
is this passes. Part of the problem? Because the Georgian government is claiming that much of the unrest is being fomented by Russia.
Russia can't get used to the idea that Georgia is independent.
It's the home of Stalin. It was the home of their most notorious leader.
It was that, but also it was their playland. This was their vacation land. But there's something invisible, abstract to that. To be honest, I haven't put my finger on about Georgia and about Georgians expressing independence that drives the Russian leadership crazy. And it's not just Putin. It was Yeltsin also. And they behave irrationally when it comes to Georgia.
So Russia's getting no piece of this action?
No. Russia had a Lukoil, the Russian oil company, had a piece of the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. They decided to sell it. and had a piece of the offshore Baku and decided to sell that to Russia. Has been invited in, not in a with a controlling stake, but the main role of these oil deals really was to become part of the world economy and really to try to give themselves some leverage against the geographic reality being that there is no way ultimately that they will ever not be dominated by Russia.
Steve Levine is my guest. He's written a book called The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. It's published by Random House. Well, oil prices keep on going up. We're now nearing $100 a barrel. So the availability of all of this oil doesn't seem to have had all that much of an impact on the world market.
Well, it's in the early stages. Baku is shipping 1 million barrels a day. Kazakhstan ships about a million, a little bit less than a million. If those barrels were not on the world market, the price would already have shot over 100. But looking forward into the next decade, you will have conservatively speaking 5 million barrels a day out of there, and they will help to temper world oil prices.
We talked earlier about James Giffen, who you spend a lot of time profiling here, and who is a major player both with the Soviet Union and then with the countries that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union. But he's out of the picture now because of other problems, isn't he?
Yeah. A few years ago, when Giffen was really at the top of his game in Kazakhstan, he lives right up here in Westchester County, and he was driving from there to JFK to take one of his routine trips to Kazakhstan, and he was met at the airport and handcuffed by the FBI and charged in the biggest foreign bribery case in U.S. history. And what he's accused of is channeling about $80 million in payments from U.S. oil companies to the president of Kazakhstan and associates of his, what the U.S. government is calling bribes to make these oil deals go through. And that case has been going on for 3.5 years.
What's taking so long? There's no trial.
Giffen's defense. Giffen has arrived at a novel defense, and what he claims is that the whole time he was in Kazakhstan and doing these deals, and not incidentally disputing the claims in the indictment about the payments, that he in effect was an asset of U.S. intelligence agencies. And so he's claiming that the whole time he was doing what's described in the indictment, he was serving American interests, and he understood that it was okay.
I wonder if Vladimir Putin is aware of this defense. So there's another problem, isn't there, that a pipeline is not the easiest thing to put together in this area, just because of the geography of it?
Well, sure. There are a number of things. The Baku-Jehan pipeline meanders. It climbs over enormous mountains, and the pumps have to be carefully calibrated for that. They go through war zones. We've heard about in Turkey the continued activity of the Turkish Kurds, and this pipeline goes through their turf. In addition to that, there's the...
there are political implications here.
Political, geographic, geopolitical.
What about the situation for the people in the area? Has their situation improved as a result of all this new money coming into it?
There are a couple of things. Environmental groups have had a role in the construction of the pipelines, and social groups have raised issues about them. People along the route were paid for their land, for the use of their land. But I think the main thing that really have that I keep in mind is that this pipeline put Georgia, for example, on the map. The Georgians who I spoke to, Edward Shevardnadze and his people, who really made this pipeline work, they regarded as that pipeline as a way to make Georgia important to the world, and that's exactly what it's done.
Well, Azerbaijan's oil production, you point out, will peak late in the next decade, and it's not my sense that the profits are being used to help anyone in the future. Kazakhstan's president Nazarbayev is building a grandiose new capital, complete with a glass pyramid. And this summer he granted himself the constitutional right to be president for life. So, is anything going to improve as a result of this?
Well, this is really a good point that you raise. The presidents there have become the equivalent of Middle East potentates, and they're ruling families, and they have used the money to create their own wealth. I do divide the futures of those two countries differently. I think that Azerbaijan will have a sad future because its oil is going to decline relatively soon in the next decade, and not enough has been done to create an alternative industry. Kazakhstan has done better, and so I expect it to have a much brighter future.
Steve Levine's book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune in the Caspian Sea, is published by Random House, and it's a story that I guess so many people don't even realize is happening, despite the fact that oil is so important to our lives. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyday products like cosmetics and cleaning supplies, Americans of all ages have a wide range of toxic substances in their bodies. On tomorrow's show, find out what the U.S. government needs to do to better regulate these substances. Also, the Berlin Philharmonic's tour of North America, now stopping here in New York. We'll hear some disaster ballads from the early 20th century. Plus, Al and Larry Ubell answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Stephanie Hughes, Rachel Krantz, and Angie Sheldon. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.